You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the 18th teleseminar in our series, Exploring the Noetic Sciences. Tonight's program explores Buddha's brain, the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom, with our special guest, Dr. Rick Hansen. And now I'll turn things over to our host, IONS Research Director, Cassandra Veeton.
Thank you, Jeff, and welcome to everyone who is on the call. I am Cassandra Veeton, the Director of Research at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Rick Hansen, who is a clinical psychologist, a neuroscientist, who is particularly interested in the intersection of contemplative practice and neuroscience. He is someone who has a wealth of expertise in this area. He is, San Francisco State trained, UCLA. He received his PhD in clinical psychology from the Wright Institute in Berkeley. He is also the author of Buddha's Brain, as Jeff said, the practical neuroscience of happiness, love, and wisdom, also co-authored by Rick Mendius with a foreword by Daniel Siegel and Jack Kornfield. He's also the author of a book called Mother Nurture, A Mother's Guide to Health in Body, Mind, and Intimate Relationships. And that book is the way that Rick and I first came into contact through my own work with mindfulness during pregnancy and motherhood. Rick Hansen also offers a free, lovely, I believe it's weekly, email newsletter called Just One Thing. And if you don't receive this email newsletter yet, I highly encourage you to do so. It's a wonderful set of information and reminders for how to live a conscious life, and you can sign up for that newsletter and learn more about Rick Hansen at rickhansen.net. And in addition to all that, I'd just like to say that Rick is a really wonderful friend. He is quite an amazing person who really embodies everything that he writes about and teaches. And so welcome, Rick.
Oh, that's really touched me, Cassie. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
So for those of us who are here on the call, one of the things I'd like to ask you, first of all, you have talked a little bit about contemplative neuroscience. What exactly is contemplative neuroscience?
It's the study of what happens in the brain when people are doing contemplative practices, broadly defined, and also how their brain gets changed by those contemplative practices. So to bring it down to earth, while the word contemplative sounds really fancy, everyone's been contemplative. You know, just standing outside and looking up at the stars, or going to the ocean and getting a sense of the enormity of it all, or looking in your baby's eyes and going, holy moly, how did I get you and how did you get me? Whatever. All that's contemplative. In addition to that, of course, are the formal contemplative practices or prayerful practices and all kinds of disciplines. You know, all the major religions and all the other religions have a contemplative wing, and people can engage in contemplative activity even without, you know, framing it in terms of a relationship with God or something like that. The one I know best is Buddhism. It's also the contemplative tradition that's had the greatest crossover with Western science. So most of the research on, much of the research on meditators has been on Buddhist meditators, but actually, arguably, the majority of research has been on people who do TM, which is, as you know, nested in more of a Hindu tradition. So that field, contemplative neuroscience, is just exploding. I mean, it's exploding consistent with the explosion of knowledge about brain science in general. In other words, people know twice as much today about the brain than they did in 1990. It's really quite remarkable. And also, I'd have to say we know scientifically 100 times more today about what happens in the brain when people do contemplative practices and then how those practices change the brain than we did in 1990. And I'll give you a couple examples, Cassie, if you want, because probably a lot of the people in on this call do some kind of mindfulness practice or meditation or prayer or something regularly. In terms of enduring changes in the brain, which are kind of the, in a way, the like the sexiest in a sense, the most exciting, people who routinely meditate, just to use that one, have a thicker brain. In other words, they build synapses and synaptic networks and layers of capillaries, the little tiny blood vessels that bring metabolic supplies like glucose or oxygen to busy regions. They literally build layers of that that are measurably thicker in an MRI in two major regions of their brain. One, the part of the brain in the prefrontal cortex, kind of right behind the forehead, that's involved in the executive control of attention. In other words, deliberately paying attention to something. And that, of course, makes sense because that's what you're doing when you're meditating or doing some kind of contemplative prayerful activity. The second area that gets bigger is a very important part of the brain called the insula. And that part both tracks the interior state of the body as well as tracks the feelings of other people, which is fundamental to empathy. So people who routinely tune into their own bodies through some kind of mindfulness practice, let's say, make the insula thicker in their brain, which helps them become more self-aware and also helps them become more empathic to others. And this is a good illustration here. Maybe I'll just make this point and wrap up on it. It's a great illustration of what is called neuroplasticity, which is the idea that as the mind changes, the brain changes, or as the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb put it, in essence, neurons that fire together wire together. So immaterial thought, you know, which we could talk later what we mean by mind. I think of it as information flowing through the nervous system. Immaterial information, immaterial thought, including what's in the field of consciousness or awareness right now, what people rest, or in the traditional saying from Buddhism, the mind takes the shape of whatever it rests upon. Or more exactly, the brain takes the shape of whatever the mind rests upon. So if you rest your mind routinely on regrets, resentments, quarrels with others, feeling inadequate, self-reproach, and, you know, that voice in the back of the head yammering away about what a nobody you really are, if others only knew, et cetera, et cetera. If you rest your mind on that, it'll change your brain in that direction because neurons that fire together wire together for better or worse. On the other hand, if you rest your mind on the themes, for example, or the topics that are so prevalent at IONS, like, you know, the one you just mentioned, Jeffrey did at the top of the hour, you know, that Marilyn is, you know, involved with, topics like that, then you will change your brain in better ways. In other words, if you routinely think about things that are going well, what you're grateful for, the kind of connections you do have with others, the good qualities inside yourself, what you accomplish in the day, the conditions in the world that are okay, or even better than okay, if you do that, you're going to build up the neural substrates. You're going to build up the neural circuits of resilience, self-confidence, a more positive mood, less anxiety, less stress, and greater capacities to engage in spiritual practices. And that whole idea that you can use your mind to change your brain for the better is what my book's organized around and what, to me, is incredibly exciting these days at a time when the world, obviously, is on the edge of the sword. But this fundamental skillfulness having to do with self-directed neuroplasticity, that you are deliberately, in a targeted way, you know, lighting up the neural networks of happiness, love, and wisdom, let's say, is a great resource as we face the challenges, you know, of a world that's just way overheated, way too driven by greed, hatred, and delusion, you know, the three poisons in Buddhism, or the Buddhism identifies, and one, you know, in which we've got caveman, cavewoman brains armed with nuclear weapons. So I hope we can really talk about some of these things in this interview.
Definitely. And one of the things that is, you know, you said it's so exciting. And in some ways, even though the field of contemplative neuroscience is burgeoning and blossoming, and it's been on the cover of Time magazine and headlines in newspapers and subjects of PBS series, it's still quite groundbreaking to understand that the relationship between mind and matter, in this case, the relationship between your own mind and your own subjective experience and your own intention and attention, can actually have physical effects on your body and your brain that are long-lasting and dramatic and profound and permanent, still is quite, groundbreaking. It's really I think to many people it's surprising that the mind-matter connection doesn't just go one way, it goes two ways. And so one of my questions for you is, when we talk about mind and matter, how would you define mind? You started to hint at information flowing, but what is mind? What is consciousness?
Sure. Thank you. Well, as soon as you're in this territory, right, we're in the deep end of the pool, and we're talking about things that philosophers have written and argued about for thousands of years, right? And then, you know, spiritual people have come in, and there's kind of a major, you know, movement in the West these days. It's a little bit like, you know, a giant salad blender, you know, with all kinds of stuff mixing together spiritually. So it really helps, I find, when you're dealing with messy, you know, highly important topics, to be really clear in the words, because then you know what you're talking about. So basically how I would say this is a common way of thinking about this in neuropsychology. I think of the nervous system headquartered in the brain as matter. It's material, right? I mean, yes, and matter, by matter, of course, I mean energy as well. E equals mc squared. It's materiality, broadly defined. Now, mind is the flow of information through that material nervous system. For example, when people understand the meanings of the words that we're talking about here, that meaning, the information, in other words, that constitutes that meaning, is being carried by a physical substrate of some kind or another, whether it's the you know, vibration of the air molecules, literally, as the sound waves move through it, or if it's carried by, you know, in complicated ways, through signals traveling across the internet or cell phone towers or inside telephone lines. In other words, immaterial information is carried by a material substrate, is represented, more exactly, by a material substrate. The computer metaphor is a really good one here. You know, there's all kinds of immaterial information that's represented by material hard drive, random access memory, screens, and so forth. All right? So that's mind and matter. In that definition of mind, as all the information flowing through the nervous system, it becomes very clear that most of mind is outside of awareness at any given time, and actually most of mind is forever outside of awareness. If someone does something fairly routine, like pick up a coffee cup or scratch their ear, the motor scripts buried in, you know, the lower layers of the, you know, buried in the brain in different places, you know, are not accessible to consciousness. You can't look at your hand and say, okay, hand, rise. You know what I mean? You just have to intend it somehow, and it works, right? But that's outside of the field of awareness. So, you know, one of the takeaways for me here is that, you know, even though we tend to privilege what's in the field of awareness, it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's honestly, it's the tip of the iceberg, really, of all of mind. And one of the really useful things to do is to use attention, mindful attention, which is kind of like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner, because it, you know, illuminates what it rests upon, but then sucks it into your brain, because neuroplasticity is turbocharged for what's in the field of focused attention. Neurons that fire together do wire together in terms of unconscious movements of information through the nervous system, but the neurons that are firing in the focal field of attention, particularly sustained attention, wow, those really, really wire together, because, of course, that's how Mother Nature wants us to learn from our conscious experiences. So the point, the takeaway, is to use mindful attention to rest awareness on things that are useful to you, and then, you know, work skillfully with what's in the field of awareness to get those neurons firing together so they wire together and therefore plant seeds in the overall garden of the brain, which then grow out of sight in that unconscious soil, fertilized by other factors as well, and end up, you know, growing and thriving and flowering and bearing fruit and all that sort of stuff, not to pursue that metaphor too far. And you build wholesome tendencies inside yourself. You gradually start inclining the mind, broadly defined, in an ever more wholesome direction.
So let me ask you this, Rick. When you use the phrase vacuum cleaner, one thing that comes to mind for me is that many people in their everyday lives, they almost feel a reverse vacuum cleaner, that their attention is compelled by things in their environment rather than them being behind the spotlight and directing where it goes. So, for example, there are things in the environment that seem to magnetically attract our attention. And it seems like often those things, sometimes those things are wholesome. They're profound experiences of awe or joy or wonder or beauty. Sometimes, and perhaps more often for many people, the things that really attract our attention are things that are not so wholesome or good for us. They're things that we orient towards that kind of suck our attention toward them. And so how do you, you know, in your model, how do you propose working with that sort of sucking toward things that are actually not as useful to direct attention to, but feeling sort of involuntarily attracted towards those things?
Sure. Well, first I would say that the model, so-called, you know, that I'm working with is I would say the commonly held view, generally speaking, in terms of people, for example, who are doing research in terms of this particular topic, you know, on attention. What you're really talking about, first of all, is our nature as, you know, animals at the top of the food chain that are the product of really, you know, 3.5 billion years of evolution of life on the planet altogether, but in particular 600 million years of the evolution of the nervous system. And on that long run, our ancestors that were really good at resting attention on something benign and then just holding it there for long periods of time, chomp, they got eaten because they weren't noticing, they were not nervously scanning for shadows and slithers and snarls and things like that. So we are the great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren of very nervous and very cranky ancestors, all right? So the nature of the brain is to have, in effect, literally, monkey mind, all right? And then on top of that, gosh, we live in a total ADD culture, you know? We are bombarded. I mean, people, I've seen studies where people talk about the number of, you know, titillating media messages a person gets a day. Like, how many commercial advertisements does the average person see in a day? I mean, now, they may not see super consciously, but it does enter the field of awareness, even if it's not in the exact focus of attention. I mean, it literally is in the zone of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of commercial messages a day. Or alternately, think about how many messages a day people are getting that play on themes of threat, themes of fear. I mean, just go to the airport. It's threat level orange. Every 90 seconds, you get a recorded message telling you that it's very, very scary out there, because orange is, as we know, the last stop before red. So the combination of that, in other words, our biological tendency, combined with, of course, personal history, and then combined with culture, and a culture as well that's involved in rapid multitasking, as we've grown habituated to an incredibly dense incoming stream of media. So in that larger context, it's totally understandable that the untrained mind is continually scanning for either something to want or something to fear. In other words, either something to want, or a problem to solve. And that's why, you know, as William James said, as you know, Cassie, well over 100 years ago, the education of attention would be an education par excellence. Because if you don't have control over that, you know, spotlight and vacuum cleaner, if, in other words, exactly as you said, it's stimulus-bound, to use the fancy phrase from cognitive psychology, and it's, in a sense, hijacked by advertisements out, or, you know, threats out there, or much more often, actually, it's hijacked by stuff just kind of randomly bubbling up in here, you know, from inside the mind itself. If that happens, then you pretty much have no control over what, you know, over how your brain is changing over time.
Right. One of the things I
use, that's not a good thing.
Is the analogy of a pinball machine. You know, I think that many people's attention are kind of like the pinball, and we're just, you know, in many ways, often we're bouncing from thing to thing to thing without a whole lot of intentional desire to bounce that way, but just being pulled from, you know, bumper to bumper to bumper throughout our days. And so, you know, you talk about practical neuroscience and training, and how is it that we can begin to shift that habit of mind? You know, I think that many people feel a little bit, again, I guess the word is involuntary, or they feel a little helpless as they're being drawn from thing to thing to thing. And what you're saying is there are actually ways that you can train the capacity to be more of a searchlight. And what are some of the ways that we can do that?
Yeah, fantastic. I'd love to get into that. And just to contextualize it, there are thousands of years of methods of attentional training. You know, sometimes people describe the contemplative practitioners who have, you know, a lifelong practice that includes sometimes, in many cases, several hours a day, if not many hours a day, of meditation. They're described sometimes as the Olympic athletes of mental training. So these various traditions in different ways have methods, and they work if people really, really do them. What neuroscience has added and what, you know, I've really tried to do is to add value there. In other words, by understanding and studying what's going on in the brain when it's being really stably mindful, when there is steadiness of mind, as it's spoken of traditionally, well, then what you can do in clever ways, particularly for people who do not live in a monastery or a cave or a rural agrarian, you know, culture, but are, you know, dodging cars in Manhattan or something, you know, there are ways to, in a very targeted way, nourish the neural substrates of attention that are very useful. So if you like, I'll take people through a practice of 5 basic suggestions. Anyone can do any one of these to whatever extent they want. So I'll just do it right now. But like any practice, don't do this while you're driving. And, you know, take good care of yourself. If you start feeling uncomfortable, feel very free to stop. I doubt you will, but if you do, just feel free to stop. You can do it with your eyes open or closed. It might be simpler if you do it with your eyes closed. So for starters, just bring awareness to the sensations of breathing. And if, by the way, if there's anything about that makes you uncomfortable, as is the case for some people who have a trauma history, bring your attention to something else. In other words, rest your attention on something that's mildly pleasant or simply neutral, like the sensations of breathing or the sensations in your feet or a phrase like, may I be happy or may my family be well. And then the first suggestion, make an intention to stay with that object of attention for the next few minutes while we're doing this practice. Whether it's your breath or a phrase or anything else, set the intention in your own mind to stay present with that target or object of attention. You could do that either top-down, for example, using words like, I'm going to stay attentive here, or just a single phrase or word like, mindfulness or be mindful. Or you could also do it from the bottom up by getting a felt sense inside you of someone, could be yourself, could be another person, someone who is very mindful. Now the second suggestion, really relax. Take some long exhalations. They're longer than your inhalation. And relax your tongue. And then the third suggestion, feel as safe as you reasonably can. This can be a challenge sometimes because it can make us nervous actually to feel safe because that's when we lower our guard. So help yourself here by taking a moment to recognize that wherever you are is probably quite a protected setting, quite a comfortable place. Getting a sense of the good people in your life that support you, maybe some of them nearby. And perhaps as well, a sense of your own strengths, some of your strengths, that enable you to deal with whatever life brings. So on the basis of this, explore the sense of lowering your guard some. being less vigilant or wary. Being less braced against life. Feeling as safe as you reasonably can. And on to the fourth suggestion. Open to and encourage simple feelings of well-being, much as can be there. Not straining or forcing anything, but opening to and even encouraging gentle feelings of even happiness. Maybe starting with thinking of things that you're grateful for that make you happy. Forests make me happy. Grateful for the smell of oranges. Whatever works for you. Allow as much a sense of positive emotion of any kind to fill you here as you can. There may be other feelings, even negative feelings. It's all right. Don't resist them. Let them come and let them go. And keep bringing your attention and focusing your awareness on letting yourself feel as good as you can. Then the fifth suggestion on the basis of all these so far. Get a sense of your awareness being like a boundless space. Notice that awareness has no edges, no bounds. In a sense, it's infinite. In that vast space, like the sky or space altogether, different experiences come and go. But you have a panoramic sense of them as arising and passing away in a vast space of awareness, sort of bird's eye view of thoughts, sensations, sounds, feelings, desires, memories, whatever, coming and going, a boundless open space. All right, and feel very free to enjoy whatever is worthwhile and whatever you're feeling right now. In a workshop or course I might teach, or just on your own, you could then focus on something like the breath or another object of attention, and really concentrate on it. In other words, stay with, let's say, the sensations of breathing from beginning to end, breath after breath, maybe even 100 breaths in a row. And we won't do that here in this teleseminar, but I've found again and again and again with people that those five simple suggestions are a great preliminary practice. It takes about 5 minutes. With practice, you can actually start doing it very quickly because you know how to go there, right? You know how to light up those circuits. And on the basis of it, wow, you really can steady the mind. Would you like, Kathy, for me to tell people what was happening in their brain during each one of those five suggestions?
That's great, yes.
Okay, and feel very free to stay in that nice place if you're in a nice place. I'll do it kind of quickly. Setting an intention top down, people lit up the prefrontal cortex, as I said, part of the brain kind of right behind the forehead. There are a lot of executive systems there. They used inner language. Most people, especially if they're right-handed, activated systems in the left temporal lobe on the side of their head. Let's say just kind of above their ear around the temple. the bottom-up form of setting an intention I find really interesting because, you know, over the centuries, top-down intention has kind of gotten most of the press, but bottom-up is actually really, really important as well because then, hang on a second here, sorry, you're getting an embodied sense, an emotionally rich sensory or, you know, inclination in one direction or another. And that form of setting intentions is actually very powerful. Okay, and that's, you know, in the brain, that engages the literally the brainstem in terms of levels of activation and energy, having energy for your intentions. And also it engages the limbic system or the subcortical regions underneath this cortex that are involved in emotion. So you start having emotionally positive rewards associated with your intentions. You know, it's like dangling a carrot, you know, before a donkey. If you hold that reward of these emotionally positive associations to your intentions, you know, if you link those two, then you'll naturally move more in that direction. Okay, second suggestion is to relax. We chronically, particularly in the modern age, have activation of our stress response fight or flight systems. A major system or subsystem related to that is the sympathetic nervous system. We did evolve, of course, to handle brief bursts of stress, but not chronic stress. It's really hard to be mindful when you're stressed out because that activates those really, really skittery monkey mind, you know, tendencies in the brain. You know, makes sense to scan for tigers jumping out of you from different bushes. So if you want to calm down that, you know, monkey brain scanning, it's really important to calm down sympathetic arousal, and the way to do that is by activating the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, the so-called rest and digest wing of the autonomic nervous system. That's a part of the nervous system that keeps us on an even keel. Great way to do it is through exhalation because the parasympathetic handles exhaling. So if you have a lot of long exhalations, like 3 to 10, say, not even that many, you can really light up those parasympathetic circuits and calm down sympathetic arousal. Similarly, because it's the digest system, if you relax the tongue or the lips, that's another way also to light up the parasympathetic nervous system. Then feeling safe. This is really an important one. It's often hard for people, but it's really important because we have what I call paper tiger paranoia. We evolved to be, we evolved essentially to overestimate threats, underestimate opportunities, and underestimate resources, either for dealing with threats or, you know, fulfilling opportunities. And while that may have been a great way to pass on gene copies in Africa, you know, 2 million years ago, it's a lousy way to have quality of life, you know, in the 21st century. So most people actually can feel safer than they normally do. That's why I say feel as safe as you reasonably can. There's no perfect safety in this life. None of us is safe from old age, disease, and death, for example. But on the other hand, most of us can afford to feel less guarded and less braced and have more confidence in our capacities to meet life. The reason that helps mindfulness, in addition to obvious general benefits, is that when we feel unsafe, guess what? We're, of course, continually scanning for threats. It increases external vigilance and gets in the way of, you know, internal self-awareness. It's probably no accident that in the traditional stories of the Buddha's own awakening, he had his back to the Bodhi tree. The tree had his back. It protected him from the direction that most lethal threats come from in the wild, from behind us. And it forced Mara and the other forces of, you know, delusion and so forth to come at the Buddha from the front where he could deal with them. He was feeling as safe as he reasonably could. Okay, the fourth one about well-being or happiness. The reason for that is that, and this will be a little technical, but I'll do it kind of quickly. And people are, by the way, welcome to go to my website, buddhasbrain.com. We'll take you there, where I have a lot of resources, including some of these meditations, and it's all freely available. The way attention works, so if you want to be mindful, right, and you don't want to have that monkey mind and you don't want to be constantly hijacked, you're resting your attention on what you want it to rest upon, whether it's the sensations of breathing or a loving kindness phrase or a prayer or maybe some investigation you're doing in your mind, like you're trying to be aware of how things continually change or whatever it is. Well, that means that you've got to hold that focus in the field of attention, which means holding it in what's called working memory. Interestingly, the neural substrate of working memory has a kind of gate that is either open or closed, right? If it's closed, the contents that are in working memory stay there. And what that translates to in terms of your experience is that you have steadiness of mind. You're staying with whatever you want to keep paying attention to. But And the way that work, the way the gate works is through dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It tracks rewards, and what keeps the gate closed is steady dopamine. But what pops the gate open is either a drop of dopamine, which means the rewards are falling off, or a spike of dopamine associated with some brand new rewards that are even sweeter than whatever it was you're paying attention to. So if you open up to and encourage strong feelings of well-being as much as you authentically can without forcing it, what you're doing is doing two things. Number one, you're creating steady dopamine, which keeps the gate closed, and because it's highly rewarding, you're having dopamine at the high end of its range, so you cannot get a spike of dopamine. And those two things in combination help keep the gate closed to working memory and thereby steady the mind. And then the last thing, the whole thing about a panoramic view, you know, regarding the field of awareness as like a boundless space, what that does, consistent with some research that literally is just a few years old, is that it moves, it basically activates circuits on the side of the head, lateral networks, especially on the right side of the head, that are associated with mindful, open, spacious awareness. And it moves people out of the conventional state of mind in which there are midline circuits right in the middle of the brain, the top of the skull, that are busily planning things, thinking about the past, using language, engaging in abstraction, you know, with a lot of sense of self and me, myself, and I. And there's a place for that, right? Okay? But modern life and modern schools, conventional schools at least, alas, are a deep training in the activation of midline networks. And guess what? Neurons that fire together wire together. So we get a lot of, you know, buildup in those regions. That's why with training, it takes training to stably activate those lateral networks. One of the ways to activate those lateral networks that are one of the neural substrates of spacious awareness is through a panoramic view. There are a couple others, surprise, not knowing, not needing things to make sense. For example, those are other ways to light up those lateral networks. But one of the very best of them is the sense of boundless awareness or kind of a bird's eye panoramic view. But right there, Cassie, is an illustration. Five simple methods that, based on good science, reliably stimulate the neural substrates of, you know, mindful attention. And if you stimulate the neural substrates of something wholesome, like mindful attention, over time you naturally strengthen them. Because, of course, as neurons fire together, they wire together. And that's an illustration of a broader principle that a person can apply to their relationships in terms of building up the neural substrates, for example, of compassion on the one hand or assertiveness on the other. They can use it to build up the neural substrates of self-worth, self-esteem, feeling good about who they are. They can use it to build up the neural substrates of resilience so they're less rattled by stress or the residue of painful childhood experiences. And they can, of course, as well, build up the neural substrates of spiritual insight and, you know, the deep concentration that lets people go into non-ordinary states of awareness like samadhis or in Buddhism called jhanas. So that's pretty great, you know, and that's a good example of how to be more mindful and a good illustration more generally, you know, of self-directed neuroplasticity.
That's lovely. Thank you, Rick. I am just, you know, one of the things that stays with me about that is that, you know, to do the practice that you just led us through, one of the things I noticed is that you didn't recommend any particular bells or chants or robes or doctrines or dogmas. Mm. And it's something that you can really do in your everyday life as often as you want to do it. And I think even though many of the people on this call and in the world believe that their consciousness matters, there's still a little bit of a programmed feeling that, you know, it doesn't really matter what I do. It matters what happens to me. And the thing that really stays with me about what you're saying is it does matter where I rest my attention. It does matter what I intend to focus on. And not only does it matter in a sort of ephemeral way, it actually matters in a very physical way that trains my brain to be more the way I want it to be more wholesome, to be a better person, to be happier. And so what I'd love to do now is open the conversation to people who have called in and I'm sure have many questions for you, but I really appreciate that practice and looking forward to hearing what people have to either comment or ask about what Rick and I have talked about so far.
Great.
If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Hansen, just press 1 on your phone. I'll bring you the virtual mic. I'll try to take people in roughly the order that they pressed the button. We'll take our first question from Ben. You have the mic. Go ahead.
In terms of this brain capacity build up through practices, I'm just wondering if you've checked anything on individuals using reasoning versus using intuiting as having any differences in brain capacity buildup.
That's a great and interesting question. Ben, could you say what you mean by intuiting?
Yeah, in terms of noetic, the idea that we're working on is that it's intuitive direct knowing without the use of reason.
Okay,
and
I got it.
We've been using that for a while, and we've been exploring consciousness within that context.
Yeah. Well, first let me affirm that I think there, without a doubt, and modern psychology would agree. I mean, you know, in the old days, there was a, particularly the behaviorist era, there was a certain prejudice, a serious prejudice against things like intuition. But now, increasingly, people are recognizing that there are all kinds of processes going on in the brain that are nonverbal and not even conscious, but there's a kind of just simply direct gestalt of a kind of certainty of the way something really, really is. And in addition to whatever, of course, might well be transcendental or, you know, or spiritual, you know, infusing all that. So the what I would answer that is that, you, how can I put it, to the extent that, whatever it is the mind is doing is activating neural circuitry, the tendency of that circuitry is to form structure, that it just does it automatically. It's a little bit like using a muscle. You don't have to tell the muscle to get bigger. It just gets bigger if you use it. Now, if you want to really make it bigger, basically three things build neural structure in particular. One is the intensity of their activation. The second is the duration of activation. And the third is, you could say, the multimodality, really, or the complexity of the activation. You know, it's like any school teacher knows. If you get the students really, you know, intensely engaged with something for a long period of time and you engage them actively and experientially, they're more likely to learn it than if you drone at them and they're half asleep, you know, in the back of the room. So in that sense, I think arguably intuitive knowings are going to build up more neural structure than the fruits of reason alone, because intuitive knowing tends to, by its nature, engage the right hemisphere in terms of a kind of a visual spatial gestalt. There's often a felt sense people report. I have a good friend who's working on a book called The Feeling of Presence. In other words, what does it feel like to really be present or to really know something intuitively? So I think you're really onto something here in terms of preferentially building neural structure through intuitive training.
Then how do you relate awareness to consciousness?
You mean how do I use those words? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'll say this briefly because otherwise, boy, we could be, you know, having one of those dorm conversations at 3 in the morning, you know.
I'll email you then.
Oh, no, it's totally cool. I like the word awareness because honestly, again, when you're dealing with big, murky, metaphysically saturated topics like consciousness, it helps to bring them down. So I think my cat is aware of a mouse. I think a mouse is aware of my cat. I think at a certain basic level, literally, you can train an earthworm to turn left at a junction rather than right to avoid a little electrical shock down the right-hand pathway. So at some level, that earthworm is aware of the directionality left versus right. You know, in human beings, of course, we are aware of many, many things, and it's very clear that there's a neural substrate involved in awareness, because if you damage that substrate, you can damage awareness. Or if you do little things like anesthetize, you know, a person, you're changing the neural substrates of awareness. How the brain forms awareness, in other words, how you and I right now are aware of, like I'm looking out my window, I'm seeing the hills in the distance, the Tibetan flags, you know, hanging on a wire, and things like that. I'm aware of, you know, your warm voice, Ben, and all the rest of that. How the brain actually does that, nobody knows. But there's a core assumption that has not ever been really contradicted, that most, if not all, of what it takes for awareness to occur is the operation of the nervous system.
Is that consciousness?
I use the term awareness as synonymous with consciousness. I also respect the fact that people often mean the word consciousness to be tantamount to something that's universal and cosmic and transcendental, that transcends the nervous system. My own personal belief is that there really is something like that, but within the frame of Western science, at least, a person does not have to presume that to investigate the neural substrates of awareness or how people can do either useful or harmful things with their awareness and what it contains. And that's kind of where I go. I tend to be a fairly practical guy. That's what my book's really about. It's about practical methods for daily life. You know, I'm really interested. I don't think I'm going to be able to answer. I don't think there's enough data yet. I think it's going to be, we're centuries away. You know, this question about how in the world does awareness work? How in the world do we see the color red? You know, the qualia and all the rest of that. That's considered one of the three great scientific questions of the age. You know, and the other two are what caused the Big Bang and what's the grand unified theory of everything? You know, how does quantum mechanics integrate with, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity and gravity? You know, how to, like literally, how are we aware is equal to those other two questions in its profundity and its difficulty. So meanwhile, you know, I try to work in my own garden. You know, I try to help people have more love, happiness, and wisdom in daily life and, you know, use what we know at least here and now in practical ways for the better.
Thank you.
I appreciate people who pursue consciousness studies. I find it really deeply interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Just want to remind everyone on the call, you can press 1 if you have a question or comment for Rick. And bringing the mic over now to Mayanna. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Hansen, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience and knowledge and wisdom. It's just been absolutely wonderful. And I also want to say thank you for that meditation, because that's one of the few that I've ever heard that puts expectations in line with reality and has folks meet themselves where they are and start there. So that was really wonderful. I've been listening to for several years now the Mind and Life conferences that the Dalai Lama holds with the Mind and Life Institute. And it's a panel for folks who are not aware of that. It's a panel of scientists who do brain studies and psychology studies and that sort of thing, too, and a panel of Buddhists who look introspectively at the mind and have their own studies of mind that way. And I've been delighted at how each informs the other and really opens up this dialogue so that we can have a more holistic understanding of what's going on.
That's great.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, in those conferences, one of the things that's very, well, it's pointed out, are the two paradigms that folks use, where you have material realism, where thought is an epiphenomena of the brain and everything, you know, the matter is the basic of what is. And then also consciousness being the other paradigm, where it's the basis, and both matter, energy, and thought are epiphenomena of it. So I think when I was hearing some of the definitions that you were using, I think it's worthwhile for me to realize that those definitions are really wonderful within that paradigm, because it's more or less what I find in Western science is a paradigm of material realism, where thought is an epiphenomenon of the brain, whereas where I hear Buddhist and more Eastern traditions, that's not necessarily the case. And so when they talk about mind, they're not necessarily talking about information going through a material substrate so much. So what I wanted to ask you is about brain studies. One of the things we've been able to do is look at areas of the brain when they're damaged. That's where we've gotten a whole lot of our information saying this no longer works. So it helps us understand what that part of the brain is doing. And from a material realism point of view, that's saying that the brain creates that sort of thing. But I kind of wonder if, with the consciousness paradigm, looking at the brain being a receiver and that thought is an epiphenomena and it's the brain activity is a shadow of that thought, and what we're measuring is the shadow.
Yeah.
That if you hurt a radio receiver components in some way, well, you know, it can't work like it used to. Some things may work, other things may not. And so I wonder in your studies how you envision that holistic viewpoint, since you do practice meditation and you do have an awareness of a bigger picture.
Thank you for, wow, what a wonderful, please say your name again. I didn't quite catch it.
May Anna.
Bay Anna?
May.
May Anna. May Anna. Thank you, May Anna. That was really great. Well, if I could, and again, in the spirit of, cooperative dialogue here, I would just, myself, I would like to unpack what you said in two ways, all right? First, I myself, and I think, again, most current neuropsychologists would not think of mind as an epiphenomenon of brain. In other words, arguably, mind is actually causally prior to brain, because the function of the brain is to serve the mind, and the mind uses the brain to make the mind, particularly minds, I'm kind of shifting my meaning of the word here in a play on the word, minds that can use language like you and I are using it here and have intentions and can step back and look at the way, and can minds that can step back and look at mind and realize that, wow, I could help my own mind to change over time by doing X, more of X and less of Y, right? So, you know, the modern model really is that the mind and the brain co-arise. I think the Buddha would appreciate that notion. They interdependently and co-arise. They're mutually causal. You know, the on the one hand, in the conventional sense of mind, without getting to something transcendental, which I'll get to in a moment, the brain is the necessary condition for mind. But on the other hand, mind continually, this flow of information, which becomes self-organizing, right? It transforms the brain gradually over time. So that's point one. Point two, I love the Dalai Lama, and I really appreciate the Mind and Life conferences. I did a summer research institute a year or so ago that was just wonderful. I know that world quite well. The Dalai Lama is a Tibetan teacher. The original teachings of the Buddha are really quite interesting because he was very radical, and he considered that consciousness, as he meant it, which is to, and he meant it in the sense that we're meaning it here, we're aware of things, right? He considered that consciousness dependently arose, and it arose based on conditions, and those conditions were preeminently in the body. So the more Mahayana, Tibetan Buddhist view, that there's some kind of cosmic consciousness out there that the brain is in some sense the radio receiver for, if you will, or that infuses thought or maybe is intertwining with thought. I think the Dalai Lama would probably take the stance that something that is transcendental mysteriously intertwines with immaterial, you know, informational flows that are deeply rooted in a material substrate. You know, that they both are involved. You know, that's a different view than early Buddhism, interestingly. Now, all that said, I personally think the Dalai Lama is right. I think there really is something immaterial and something transcendental that's mixed in with information. But you don't need something transcendental to account for the meaning of the words on a billboard. You know, there's a lot of immaterial information out there that's grounded in a material substrate that no one says, looky, looky, you know, it's God that's making, you know, that sign on the billboard that says, buy Gap jeans, right? You know, that's where people like Stephen Batchelor, I think, are worth reading, you know, for people that are interested in that sort of thing. You know, he has a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs, or, you know, Confessions of an Atheist Buddhist, or something like that, a Buddhist Atheist, something like that. You know, my point. All that said, in day-to-day life, I'm kind of wondering, honestly, how much difference it makes. You know, you're with your husband, you're with your child or your partner, or just going dealing with a guy next to you in the cubicle at work, and they do something that bugs you. Right then and there, how useful is it to resort to a notion of transcendental awareness? You know, maybe it is, I think, for some people, but a lot of the time, there may or may not be some kind of transcendental awareness, but boy, is it sure useful to take some long exhalations, you know, recall a time you felt safe, think about being held in someone else's arms, and on the basis of that, change the contents of your awareness right then and there, and as a result of that, change your brain. I'm not disagreeing with you, man, you know what I mean? I'm just trying to kind of go tangential a little bit with what you're saying here.
Oh, thank you so much. I think that clarifies even what I was thinking about it. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Hey, maybe, is it okay? I Speaking of meditation, I'm leading a meditation group tonight, and we're going to talk about love, and I'll probably weave in some of the really warmth, you know, that I've experienced on this call. I've got a few more minutes, though. I'm sure there's time for at least one more question or comment, maybe two.
Great. We've actually got one more question in the queue, so I will bring the mic over to Suzanne. Suzanne, you have the mic.
Hi, thank you. My question is in reference to mind-altering drugs.
Sure.
Do you find that the use of these substances is advantageous or harmful? I'm certainly not advocating the use of them, but really just like to know what you found up to this point.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. So by mind-altering drugs, we're really talking about a range here that includes aspirin, ibuprofen, caffeine, alcohol, nicotine. All those are readily available. They're all mind-altering, and in excess, they all are quite harmful. And then we have mind-altering drugs like antidepressants, Zoloft, Prozac, and so forth. Psychostimulants for ADD, let's say, like Adderall or Ritalin. And then we have, illegal mind-altering drugs like marijuana or psychedelics, cocaine, et cetera. So there you have a range, right?
Yes.
And so let's see here. This is a minefield, of course, in some ways. Yeah. Well, for one, it is obvious that certain substances can change neural activity and over time change neural structure. And by the way, I should add that some of those substances include things that you can get at your health food store. Like, for example, at a health food store, you can buy the amino acid precursors to the neurotransmitter serotonin, which is serotonin, that is a major target of antidepressants, like Zoloft or Prozac. For example, you can buy 5-hydroxytryptophan, which has a fair amount of research on it, as being, roughly about as good as an antidepressant for, mild to moderate depression. So there are a lot of ways to get, different kinds of substances, legal or illegal, that can produce enduring changes in the brain. Based on all that, if you're asking my personal opinion, it's to be pragmatic, evidence-based, cautious, and first and foremost, emphasize the mind itself. On the one hand, if I'm on a meditation retreat, which I just came back from, much of June was my retreat, I'll take Advil because I think there's some benefit sometimes to toughing it out with a back pain or a tough headache. But frankly, much of the time, I'm not there to have back pain or a headache. I'm there to go very deep in my awareness, and that headache is really getting in the way. So I think there's a pragmatic point to certain kinds of substances. And I think that there is a case, often for many people, where the net bottom line is that using a substance ranging from, honestly, having a weak scotch and soda when they get home from work at the end of a long and nutty day, or a glass of wine with their partner before diving into the kid-rearing madness, after dinner, there's a place for that, much as there's a place, I think, for the skillful use of things like, psychotropic medication, which, if we think about it, was one of the half dozen great breakthroughs in medicine in the 20th century. All that said, there are a lot of abuses and problems available, whether a drug is legal or illegal or available by prescription or over the counter. And a lot of people in our fast food culture, right, quick fix culture, go right to the prescription bottle or go right to the second or third glass of wine or go right to medicating a 7-year-old who's really, really bright and pretty bored in second grade and a little rambunctious as well, just so Johnny can, settle down and not be a pain in the neck to the teacher. A lot of people will do that long before they've done the work of training the mind over time and therefore training the brain. And, my own view about these things is that they're last resorts after people have done initial practices of one kind or another that are really, skillful. On the other hand, if you've done those initial practices sincerely, you've done what you could, for example, to help, Johnny settle down in that second grade classroom, or you've tried to help that headache go away in the meditation hall, or or you've tried to lift your mood with spiritual practices, the good therapy or what have you, and you still feel chronically depressed, well, at that point, I think, I'm very pragmatic. The bottom line is, is what is the net benefit, cost-benefit analysis, really, in terms of the brain? And I've known a number of people who really did good practices, and they felt guilty. You know, they felt guilty about taking, ibuprofen, or guilty about taking Prozac, or honestly guilty about giving their kids some Adderall. And I'm not speaking in favor of any of those steps, but I'm trying to think about this with you in a kind of a nuanced and complex way. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. I've been a therapist a long time, and Cassie's a therapist too, and I bet you would echo what I'm saying here. On the one hand, and maybe this is a good place to end this call, on the one hand, being a therapist working with people in the real world, real people with real longings, real suffering, real wounds, real hopes and dreams, it's made me a lot more compassionate. It's really tenderized my heart in a lot of ways. On the other hand, it's made me a lot tougher-minded, frankly, about the importance of work and earning your results. Routinely, I see people putting a lot of effort into getting good at things that don't really matter very much to them. It's not that they don't matter to me. They don't even matter very much to the person, learning some new widget in terms of the latest application of Windows. But they won't put much work into becoming and learning how to be more skillful in their relationships or in their child rearing, or most importantly, in how they work with their own thoughts and feelings, their own contents of awareness and with awareness itself. And I think that, the opportunity here is to do that work and to challenge ourselves to feel to have on the one hand an extraordinary sense of gratitude at this amazing organ, 3 pounds of tofu, right between the ears, the build-out instructions for which were handed to us on the day we were conceived, right? Earned by the hard efforts of, billions of creatures, trillions of creatures, across a long run of the evolution of the nervous system. It was just handed to us. So for me, I'm incredibly grateful for it. On the other hand, there's a sense of responsibility. What will we do with that extraordinary gift? For ourselves, first and foremost, because that's the foundation of helping others in any meaningful way, shape, or form. It's funny, tonight, one of the quotes I'm going to offer to people comes from the Buddha, in which he said, if one going down into a river, swollen and swiftly flowing, is carried away by the current, how can one help others across? In other words, as they say in the airplanes, put your own oxygen mask on first. So yeah, we need to do the work for ourselves, but also for the sake of others. And I guess to me that's the bottom line takeaway point, that with the advent of knowledge about the brain that's exploding all around us and is being developed through IONS and other organizations, my own work, et cetera, we can be deeply heartfelt grateful for this gift we've been handed while simultaneously having a calm, clear, and most sincere sense of responsibility for doing the best we can with it. And so anyway, on that note, I really appreciate this whole call and IONS and Cassie and everybody in this call, Jeffrey and Lindsay who helped set it all up, as well as the listeners for this. And, there are tons of resources on my website, BuddhistBrain.com. They're freely offered. You're very welcome to use them. And I really wish all of you the very best.
Oh, that's wonderful, Rick. Thank you so much. And I just want to jump in and say that I have 3 plugs to give, given the most recent conversation on this call. The first, of course, is BuddhistBrain.com, which is the website for Rick Hansen and Rick Mendius's book, Buddha's Brain, which basically tells us that we can actually, far into our later years, continue to shape our brains and our attention and our intention using some of these practices that are actually quite simple, that don't require going into a monastery or entering some sort of practice, although if that is your path, that might be another way that you do it. The other plug I want to make is for a workshop that is coming up at IONS at the end of this month, July 30th. It's called Worldview Literacy, and it's a program that we are developing to bring into high schools and middle schools and eventually into the realm of younger children as well, and this is something that teaches kids to have more awareness of their consciousness and how they can use their noetic experience to train their brains and to have some empowerment around the way their lives unfold. And the last is the work that I've done on mindful motherhood, which again was the first way that I connected with Rick Hansen, which is also a reference to his book, Mother Nurture. My book is more about the work that you can do using mindfulness during pregnancy. So I think the ending message here is that we are not helpless to our brain cells. We're not helpless to our genetics. We're not helpless to our environment. We can actually take some empowerment and have an effect on how we grow ourselves, how we grow our children, how we grow our society through these relatively simple training practices. And Rick, I just appreciate so much how you have focused so much on the practical applications of everything we're learning through the thousands of years of work on meditative practices and contemplative practices, the hundreds of years of work that have gone into the science of contemplation. And I really appreciate everyone who signed on to this phone call and hope that you have a wonderful community session after this. I know that Rick and I both have to leave at this point, and I really appreciate everyone being here.
Me too. That was wonderfully said, Cassie.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.